Okay, so my name is Ray O'Brien and I'm currently living in Oslo, Norway, and this is a picture of my office window. Enjoy! So I just would like to acknowledge the co-authors of the work and make you present several students and a colleague of mine. Can you hear me well?
You took Sianusa.
Do I need the mic? Can you hear me well?
I can hear you.
Yes, no, because I have a pretty loud voice.
Okay.
I want to talk about applications of machine learning to software testing. Obviously, there are already many articles in the research literature that make use of machine learning to support various testing activities. But I will argue, though the previous talk is actually a contradiction of that conclusion, but I will argue that it has not always been used in the most useful or practical ways. And that's probably why there is a limited usage of commercial testing tools of machine learning algorithms, and also in practice. And therefore, I think that the use of machine learning has not reached its full potential, and I will explain why. And the way I'm going to do that is that I'm going first to present three examples, and then... It's not working. It was turned off. So I will go through three examples, and then try to draw general conclusions that will support my earlier statement about the use of machine learning in software testing. The first example is about helping people define more complete, more refined black box specification test cases. The motivation here is that in practice, when people are testing large components, subsystems, systems, they mostly use black box specification approaches. They usually are not always systematic. They don't always base their test specification based on actual system specifications, but that's what they do, more or less systematically, more or less precisely. You know, nobody relies on precise data flow of the source code. I mean, I've never seen this, and there are practical reasons for that. But the problem with black box specification testing is that it's error prone. I mean, there has been a number of papers in the literature that show that, for example, when people use category partition, which is a well-known black box technique that has been mentioned before by Antonio, people make a lot of mistakes in the way they define categories and choices. And so the point here is to help them iteratively improve that test specification. And the way this is done is using machine learning, where machine learning is used to learn the relationship between inputs, execution conditions, and outputs, or rather, output equivalence classes. And then, based on the result of the machine learning, we detect anomalies in black box test specifications, and this leads, through a few steps of iterative improvement, to better test specifications. The user plays a role here. It's not fully automated, and I'll get back to that. The user has to define at least initial categories and choices and refine them. I know that there exists a lot of work in the literature about learning specification from traces and all that. But one of the reasons we take that approach, that is one of the reasons why we try to exploit test specifications, for example, under the form of categories and choices, in order to help the learning of relationships between input, execution conditions, and outputs, is that we don't think that in many situations it's very practical to learn those things purely from traces. You need some form of inputs from people who know the application domain. And I'll get back to that. So the process it can be summarized by a few steps. Basically, the user defines a category partition specification, derives a test suite from it. Then what I call an abstract test suite is built. And an abstract test suite is simply, you will see a mechanism to make certain properties of test cases explicit. We use a machine learning algorithm, for example, a decision tree, anyway, something that yields interpretable rules, decision trees, spot, jerry, there are many algorithms. We analyze in a systematic way the result of the machine learning to identify anomalies and use that information to update or refine the category partition or the test suite. And iteratively, what we hope is to converge towards a rather refined and complete test specification. So when I talk about abstract test suite, what do I mean? What I mean is using user-defined categories and choices. For example, if I take the trivial triangle example, categories, for example, can state properties about the relationship between a side one and a side two of a triangle, and the choice are possible values or equivalence classes of the category. In that case, it can be true or false. S1 is equal to S2 or it's not. And assuming you have sufficiently precise category and choice definitions, then you can transform raw values of test cases into what I call abstract test cases. So you can transform values into properties based on the categories and choices. So for example, the test case 1, 2, 2, which is the length of the three sides of the triangle, can be transformed into S1 is different from S2, S2 is equal to S3, and S1 is different from S3. So we reuse the test specification to generate abstract test cases. And of course, associated with those abstract test cases are also output equivalence classes, like saying, for example, that a triangle is isosceles. And the reason why we do that is that you will see that it facilitates learning. It allows us to really learn relationships between inputs, execution conditions, and outputs that are useful and interpretable. And anyway, what's important to point out is that those categories and choices are readily available because we are in the context of black box testing. So then you can use a machine learning tool. For example, I used Weka to generate some of the examples here. And if we generate a decision tree or classification tree using the C4.5 algorithm here, what we generate is basically a tree that partitions the abstract test suite in such a way that it leads to leaves that are very homogeneous in terms of the output equivalence classes. So in a way, it explains the relationship between input conditions and execution conditions, another form of categories and choices, and the output equivalence classes. And this is an output of Weka. It's not great, but it's a branch of a decision tree, which says, and between parentheses, you have categories, and on the right-hand side, you have choices. So for example, you have the categories that compares A and B, and the choice is that A is different from B. And if you follow a branch all the way down, it makes a prediction. It says, for example, that, well, if all those conditions are true, the triangle should be isosceles. And in the abstract test suite, there are 22 observations that match that branch or that rule. Okay? And what we do is that we basically analyze the decision tree automatically to identify anomalies. And what, for example, what kind of anomalies are we looking at? For example, we are looking at misclassifications. Here in that case, it says that, well, when you take that branch of the tree, all abstract test cases actually correspond to isosceles triangle. But what if actually, by rebuilding the decision tree, you find cases where there are misclassifications? Well, for example, 2 out of 24 abstract test cases are not isosceles. So this is an example of misclassification, which is one type of problem we are looking at when analyzing decision trees. And this, for example, that misclassification could be due to a redefined choice. For example, imagine that for the category C versus A plus B, you know, you made a mistake here. That is, instead of inferior or equal, you have inferior and vice versa. Then we have misclassification in all the cases where C is equal to A plus B. And this, that means you have misclassification that are due to an ill-defined choice in your category partition specification. So we are capitalizing many problems, not only misclassification, but the fact that sometimes there are a lot, when there is a large number of test cases in a row, or categories that are not used in the tree, or missing combination of choices in the tree. And all of those problems can be linked to a couple of possible causes. Misclassification can be due to a missing category or ill-defined choice. An unused category can be due to an ill-defined choice, a missing test cases in the test suite, or useless categories. It's possible that that category is irrelevant, actually, to the behavior of the problem, as far as your output equivalence classes are concerned. So we have done some case studies based on trained first-year engineering students who have been trained in category partition. We made them specify category partition specifications. And we tried to use that iterative approach to improve the test specifications. And what we found out is that our taxonomies of decision tree problems and causes was complete. We never found a case that we couldn't explain using that taxonomy. And the students achieved a good specification in two or three iterations. What I mean by good is something as good as we were able to produce ourselves, which may not be perfect. And basically, this resulted, of course, in additional test cases, but if you compare the number of additional test cases to the number of additional faults found, the numbers were reasonable. There were a few problems, though, in our heuristic to remove redundant test cases. We had a heuristic that I can't explain here, I have no time, but we lost a few faults in the way of reducing the size of the test suites. Now, let me go through a second example of using machine learning, which concerns test oracle. So here, the context of what I'm going to present, the technology I'm going to present is applicable in all contexts where you have iterative development and testing and no precise test oracle. So for example, image processing, speech processing, you know, all that type of software for which you cannot compute an exact oracle. You don't have an exact correct answer. Okay? And here, the objective of the machine learning is to model expert knowledge in terms of the output correctness and similarity. I'll get back to that in a minute. The usage is to avoid expensive retesting of previously successful test cases in the context you will see of image segmentations. The expert also here again plays an important role. The expert helps devise a training set to feed the machine learning algorithm, and I'll show you how. So the application context are image segmentation algorithms for heart ventricles. Okay? For supporting diagnosis of heart problems. So typically, you have a heart image in 3D, actually not in 2D, but and you have the left ventricle of the heart, and you try to automatically segment the image to identify the border of the heart ventricle. And the problem they have, a very practical problem, is that the way they currently develop those segmentation algorithms is that they devise an algorithm. They have a number of subjects that are benchmark that they use. So they segment the subjects, they do manual verification, and when they find that there is a problem, they modify the image segmentation algorithm, they resegment all the subjects, and they re-verify all the segmentations. Okay? And the problem with segmentation algorithms, like many image processing algorithms, is that it's very iterative. I mean, you constantly modify those algorithms all the time, year after year. You know? So what we did is that first we use similarity measures between segmentations. In that literature, you have a lot of similarity measures that compare segmentations. None of them are perfect. They are all kind of heuristics. Okay? Then the way we deal with the oracle problem, because what we want, I forgot to mention that, what we want is to replace that manual verification by an automated verification for all the subjects that you have already verified at least once before in a previous version of the algorithm. Okay? So what we do is that we compare the segmentation of an algorithm I with the subsequent segmentation algorithm. So we compare the version I of the segmentation with the version I plus 1. If the previous segmentation was deemed correct, and the current one is consistent, then we automatically deduce that the current segmentation is correct. If the previous segmentation was correct, but the current one is inconsistent with it, well, then we automatically deduce that the new segmentation is correct. And of course, if the previous segmentation was deemed incorrect, and the current one is consistent with it, then we predict that the current segmentation is incorrect. So what we do is that we use machine learning to be able to predict consistency or inconsistency based on similarity measures. Okay, that's what we do. So we build, for example, a decision tree, but could be any other machine learning algorithm, where we basically predict that two segmentations are consistent or inconsistent based on a number of similarity measures. Okay? And we found that it was actually very effective. In roughly 75% of the comparison of segmentations, we could predict consistency or inconsistency with a high level of confidence. So basically, we could reduce the effort of retesting segmentations by 75%. However, in 25% of the cases where manual checks were still necessary. The last example, which is about fault localization, debugging. Here again, we are, like for the first example, we are in the context of black box specification testing. And again, we are in the same context of category partition, using category partition for test specification, categories and choices. The learning objective here, the way we use machine learning objective, is to learn the relationship between input and execution conditions and failure occurrences, not output equivalence classes, like for the first example, but failure occurrences. The way we use that, we use the output of the machine learning, is to learn about failure conditions and also to refine statement ranking techniques in the presence of multiple faults, like a tarantula, for example. We have a lot of techniques in the literature to rank statements. And many of them have problems in the presence of multiple faults, when you have a large number of faults. The user's role, as usual, is to define categories and choices. And of course, they might not be perfect, but if you use the technology of my first example, chances are that those categories and choices are reasonable. That, you know, people got enough support to come up with reasonably good categories and choices. The reason why also we want to learn about failure conditions is that there has been a focus in the literature on ranking statements. But I'm not convinced that this is enough to help people debug. I mean, can you imagine if you rank 2 million statements, you know, and they all belong to different methods, you know. So you need something more. That's why also this was one of our objectives. Because when I debug, what I want to know really are failure conditions. I want to understand the conditions that trigger failures. And those failure conditions must be characterized in an easily understood form. So the way we do it is that, again, we use the abstract test suite I've mentioned in the first example. Remember how we came up with abstract test suites based on categories and choices? Well, this is the same here. Except that if I use, again, the C4.4 decision tree algorithm, the tree here is predicting whether test cases fail or pass. That's what the tree is predicting. So what you get from a branch of the decision tree is a rule that characterizes one type of failure conditions. Okay? And that's what we're interested in. Now the question is, how accurate can be those decision trees on programs? Well, if I use a well-known space program as an example, this is the confusion matrix using that approach on the test program. So you have predicted test cases and actual test cases, and what we get is basically, for failed test cases, we get a 92% precision and a 95% recall, and similar numbers for past test cases. So based, for example, on the space program, the decision trees that are built that way are very accurate. What that means is that we are capable of characterizing failure conditions in a reasonably accurate manner. It's not perfect, but it's reasonably accurate. We can explain failure occurrences. So, based on that tree, we generated actually a large number of rules that either predicted failures or success. And many rules actually predicted failure, as you can tell. And many of those rules are very accurate. In the last column here, you have the fail probability. So many rules predicted failure at a level of 100%, 99%, 98%. And if I take a rule example in the space program, the second one here, which has a 99% probability of failure, You can interpret it in a very natural manner. I mean, for anybody who knows a space program, of course, you have to know the application domain. You know, that rule says if you define a triangular grid of antennas, a uniform amplitude and phase of antennas, you define a triangular grid with angle coordinates or Cartesian coordinates, etc., then you have a 99% chance of failing. So someone who is debugging, who knows the application domain, which is usually the case of people who apply black box testing, they have to understand the system. This is very understandable. They can really understand what are the conditions that trigger failures. And if you get a high precision in recall, then you can assume that those rules are reasonably representative of actual failure conditions. Okay? Of course, if we had a low precision error recall, we couldn't trust those rules. And it can also be used to help with statement ranking. What we do, without getting into details, is that we, in each leaf of the decision tree, we consider test cases in each leaf of the decision tree separately. We don't analyze the coverage of all test cases together. Why? Because we assume that, I should get back. We assume that all the test cases in a fail leaf fail due to the same faults, because they fail under similar failing conditions. So we analyze the coverage of test cases separately for each fail leaf. And then we obtain a ranking for each fail leaf, a ranking of all statements for each fail leaf. And then we somehow combine those rankings. And this has worked very well. So for example, if we use on the space program, we use the space program with multiple faults, with many faults, not one fault at a time. And we use Tarantula, for example. And Tarantula didn't work very well. As you can tell, this is a percentage of statement covered, and this is a percentage of faulty statements. The faulty statements are ranked pretty far on the right side. The reason why there is a bar here is that when you have multiple faults, some faults are not visible, they are hidden. So your debugging process is iterative, there are several steps. Here there were two steps. Okay. So this is the first step, this is the second step. And the reason was because there were multiple faults. And this is basically more or less compromising all the ranking computations. When we applied our technique, here's what we got. In the first iteration, almost all of the buggy statements were ranked first. So, I mean, the difference is pretty dramatic. Of course, you would only observe such a difference in the presence of multiple faults. There would not be any difference if you had only one fault in the program. So, if I summarize the results from our case study with that respect, that technique was more effective than Tarantula. And the only difference with Tarantula, because we used Tarantula for the computation of the ranks, was the classification tree. So the difference in results can only be explained by the fact that we used those decision trees and that we analyzed test cases separately in each fail leaf node. Okay? Otherwise, we actually used Tarantula. We managed to characterize failure conditions accurately in terms of predicting failures. But of course, now, like for any debugging technique, and you almost never see such papers in the literature, we need to experiment with actual human debuggers to see whether that information, the ranking and the failure condition, is actually helping them find bugs faster. Because, and of course, you don't have any such studies anywhere in the literature. I mean, you know, nobody seems to worry about that. We just rank statements. So now, I presented three examples. Let me step back a minute. You have noticed that in all those applications, the human expert has an important role to play. I mean, it's not fully automated. The expert has to provide defined categories, choices. The expert has to tell us on a training set whether two segmentations are similar. The expert has to find what is the real cause of a misclassification in a decision tree, you know. And with the help of the expert, the results show that yes, this is helpful and this is useful to solve a number of problems regarding test specification or angles and localization. And so I thought, you know, of course, when we did that work, we read the literature carefully and all that. And what we noticed is that many papers attempt to solve those problems in a fully automated way. You know, you try to reverse engineer invariance from traces alone, you know, stuff like this. And we think actually that trying to aim at full automation from any problem is counterproductive. It leads to often impractical solutions. You know, like invariants you can really understand, many of them do not really make any sense. And, you know, and I think that for that type of research, what is very important is to ask the following question. What is best handled or decided by the expert, and what is best automated? We should always ask that question. You know, am I trying to go too far in terms of automation? Is that going to lead to an unscalable, awkward technology that is going to be very hard to use? And so I think our solution should aim at combining the best way possible human expertise and automated support. And that's probably the main lesson learned I can draw from those experiences. And that's, I think, something we should more often in testing research keep in mind if we want to devise practical solutions. Yeah. Thank you.
Two comments. First of all, we've talked about this before. My research group has used classification trees.
Yes.
For a different purpose, but we did end up trying to classify failures, and
yes.
We thought the trees would be diagnostically helpful.
Yes.
And they were really good at classifying failures and really not helpful diagnostically. But we were using coverage profiles.
Yes.
I believe Alex Urso's group had the same thing happen, where they got very good classifiers, but the coverage profiles when you looked at the trees from the coverage profiles, they were not useful for diagnosis because basically the learner was learning features that were correlated with failure but not causally related to failure. In your technique, apparently you're getting different results because these categories are causally related. Is that right?
Yes, because, you know, as I said before, many people use black box testing, not always in a very systematic way. But you can easily teach them to use something like category partition. It's not very difficult. I mean, it's not very difficult to deploy in a real environment. And people who know how to use category partition, who understand the application domain, which is the case of people who do system testing, you know, you may question their knowledge of testing, like, you know, like it was done earlier, but you cannot question their knowledge of the application domain. Once they know how to use category partition, they are very good at finding what are potentially relevant conditions in terms of conditions on the inputs or the execution condition. But they are not very good at looking at failures and finding out what is the cause of a failure. And this is very hard, you know? But they are good at identifying potentially useful conditions. And even if they make mistakes, in defining categories and choices, this is why we have developed the first technology I've presented. You know, trying to help people identify anomalies and refine categories and choices. But and the reason why it works is because meaningful categories and choices are defined. Basically, things that are very hard to reverse engineer from traces. I mean, it's almost impossible. Yes?
So the second part of the question has to do with the testing application as opposed to fault localization. And here what confuses me is that classification trees don't even try to come up with a perfect classification because they don't want to overfit the training data.
Yes.
So they're attempting to generalize, and the consequence of that is that some of the leaves will have positive and negative instances mixed together. Mm. So it seems like in some way you're fighting the classification tree, the design of the classification tree algorithm.
There is an assumption here. I know there were other questions. We can maybe take that more on the side because there were other questions. Is that okay if we take that on the side? Because it's very subtle. Okay. There were other comments?
With the space program, it looks like you have a very large training set. I'm wondering whether you check how well you do if you take smaller subsets of that.
Yes, you're right. With the space program, there are 10,000 test cases or something like this. If, well, of course, I mean, The ability to learn depends on the number of instances, to some extent. But usually when you do system tests, subsystem tests, or you test large components, you usually have at least a few hundred test cases, and that's what I've noticed. I mean, as you, I'm focusing on black box testers, I'm not focusing on developers testing or unit testing, but that's not the main focus. It's testing the large. And with a few hundreds test cases, you are fine, as far as I can tell. Yes?
Yes. One comment and one question. One comment. I may agree that looking for fully automated techniques may lead to, that we need to techniques that are less practical than techniques that involve expert judgment. I guess that that this should actually mostly be the case, given a certain confidence in experts. On the other hand, I think that looking for fully automated solutions gives us a better understanding of the problem, because we're trying to automate reasoning that is normally being carried out by experts.
When you say the problem, what do you mean? Do you mean the practitioner's problems or your
problems? The procedure. The procedure is solving a problem.
Yes, but the point is that what problems are we trying to solve? We're trying to solve problems that software engineers face every day in practice. So first we have to understand those problems. We have to understand what they are good at and what they have difficulties with. And what I'm saying is that we should, in the technology we develop, better take advantage of what they are good at. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we get, the typical example is all those techniques that try to reverse engineer specification from traces. And when you get the results, even on very simple programs, well, you know, I mean, you realize very quickly that you're not going to go very far with it. And it's too bad, because those practitioners who know the application domain, they can tell you a lot about what are relevant conditions in terms of execution conditions and input conditions. Why not use that, you know? And anyway, that's what they need to do when they need to do black box testing. They need to do that anyway. They have no choice, because again, they are not using white box testing to test systems. You know, when they do statement coverage, really a miracle, you know? And and there are practical reasons for that.
My question actually went into another direction. So, yeah. When you're doing making decision trees for fault localization, for instance,
yes,
you rely on the expert knowledge of the black box testing. why not also rely on, say, conditions as they occur in the program, or as they may be explicitly in there, or even inferred dynamically?
Imagine that we are doing this in the context of black box testing.
Yeah,
Someone is actually looking at inputs and all that, and then what inputs to run, etc. Let me answer your comment. So then what the user wants to know is what conditions in those inputs trigger failures. Okay? And you want that in terms of the categories and choices she or he defines, because that's what she's using to derive the black box test cases.
Okay.
That's the basis to derive the test cases. You understand?
Yes.
So in the context of black box testing, it makes sense to use black box information. But maybe there will be circumstances where mixing categories, choices, and trace information together could also be useful. I don't know. But then how to use that? Because when you do black box testing, you just select inputs and execution conditions and configurations. That's what you do, you know. Okay?
I think we should thank Lana.
Thank you.